Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin, your source for real estate investment jewels of wisdom.
Welcome to the REI Diamond Show with Jim Huntziger on buying real deals through the MLS. I'm Dan Breslin, host of the REI Diamond Show. Today's guest is Jim Huntziger from my now hometown market of Chicago. I met Jim at a recent Chicago ring meeting and knew immediately that I had to get him to come on the show. Finally, our schedules have aligned and we've gotten a chance to do the episode. If you know my story, you know that I've done more than 600 deals off market, so I only bought one of those deals using the MLS, and I actually did lose money on that deal. Well, Jim's story is a little bit different than mine, as he buys 75% of his fix and flip deals using the MLS. In fact, he's even created a program called MLS Domination, which you've probably heard of, where he's gone through and detailed his entire approach to buying real deals using the MLS. But don't worry, this episode is not a sales pitch for the program. As I usually do, in fact, as I always do with my guests, I've asked Jim some very specific questions to extract some very specific jewels of wisdom on buying deals using the MLS. And being a team player, Jim honestly answered those very specific questions and revealed as much as he possibly could within the time constraints of our episode here. So grab a pen, grab a pad for notes, and we'll get moving. Welcome to the show, Jim.
Hey, Dan, thanks for having me, bro.
Appreciate it. So for those listeners that know who Jim Huntziger is, can you give a brief background of how you got started in real estate, what your business looks like today, and the Reader's Digest version of how you got there?
I started out as a licensed agent, which I still am. I was an agent for about a year, now about 2 years, working with a lot of investors before I realized I was on the wrong side of that transaction. So I decided to become one myself. I started to kind of learn how to do the business myself. And then I became a full-time real estate investor, really 2008. And I've been, doing that ever since. And so I'm still a licensed agent. And, primarily what I've done through all that is I get all my deals out of the MLS. I get the majority of my deals out of the MLS. I have done so for the last 8 years. And so I either use direct mail for the other, because about 75% I get out of the MLS, the other 25% I either get from direct mail, which I don't do as much anymore because the other 25% generally comes from wholesalers. And through that process, I ended up doing some teaching, and I have a product called MLS Domination that actually teaches people how to use the MLS to get deals. But yeah, that's me, man. I'm primarily a rehabber. I don't do an overwhelming amount of deals. When I tell people I do, 30, 36 a year, that's a lot to people doing nothing, of course. But a lot of my buddies are doing 100, 200, 300 deals a year. Most of those guys are wholesalers, but still. And so, most of my focus these days, I have young kids and hanging out with them. And so I still do my business. But the primary focus is spending time with my family these days. But in a nutshell, that's me, man.
Nice. In a minute, we're going to go in and we're going to talk about, finding those deals on the MLS. And we're going to touch on that at a high level. If you don't mind sharing with the listeners first, I'd like to talk about kind of the sweet spot for those deals. You're doing 30 to 36 deals per year. Can you talk about what those deals were as far as like numbers, renovation budgets, costs, et cetera, what you're doing with the properties construction-wise, and then maybe how that changed as market changed, Jim?
Sure. Yeah, so I started off doing, smaller properties, anywhere from smaller in my market. I'm in suburban Chicago. I started off doing, I'd buy them for 80, 90, we'd sell them for, mid-100s up 200, and I quickly moved up. My actually second property I did was bigger than that, but a lot of what I did after that was smaller stuff. I kind of stumbled into a bigger deal that was listed for $440,000. I ended up buying it for $300,000. That was kind of part of that was back in 2007. And that was part of how I got that deal was part of how I stumbled on the rest of the MLS, what's now called MLS Domination, strategy that works so well for me and all my students. But, right now my primary purchase price is around $225,000. Like, that's my average purchase price, when I acquire them. My average rehab budget is about $80,000, though I have two right now that I'm doing that the rehab budget is over $200,000. And so I have moved towards a couple of bigger ones, bigger profit. Bigger risk. It's funny about that. We were finding out these bigger jobs, the villages right now are like out of control with permits. So the bigger your job is, I mean, it's taking like 8 weeks just to get the permits on some of these things. So, you know, that's for people listening just to watch out for, just because I say bigger profit potential. Well, you really got to worry about like the holding cost, right? So, you know, you asked about, you know, how it's evolved and what's changed. Well, there's a big change. So here you get to a point where you're comfortable doing these larger projects. But then, you know, do you allot for enough time to get the permits? You probably think, you know, oh, we'll have the permits in 2-3 weeks. Well, these guys are sending revisions back like three times. Like they give you the revisions. And I have two different villages doing this to me right now where they're giving us the revisions. Like, okay, do this and then turn them in. And then we do that and turn them in. And they say, okay, now do this and this and then turn them in. We're like, well, why couldn't you have told us that before? Because we just wasted 2 weeks. And so we do that. And now I have a village that is doing it, Arlington Heights actually, is doing it for the third time where we have. So the point is, you know, just as you grow, you got to watch out. There's always going to be changes. I've been doing this 10 years, as, you know, as an agent and an investor. And the only thing that's been true every single year is the market has changed. I've had to adapt my business in one way or another. Not major changes all the time, but there's always something different that's happened. How I have to present an offer, how you talk to agents, how fast you have to get to the deal. Every year something has changed. Now I started, you know, this, and I didn't really realize it was a blessing in disguise at the time when the market was starting to turn. That's when I became a real estate investor. And so that's all I knew. And when the market changed and started picking up, there was a whole new set of problems, believe it or not, that, I mean, it was still doable. But the funny thing is I liked it better when it was on its way down. I mean, not as a homeowner, but as an investor, because I get all my new students or people that are, you know, contemplating getting into real estate. They always are, you know, they always ask me, I get this question all the time. And it's, you know, what if the market turns again? And I always think that would be awesome. Like, you know, again, as a homeowner, I would not like that. But as an investor, how I make a living, that's how I learned it. And you could cherry pick the best deals. It was easier back then. You know, now the deals are tighter. You got to know your numbers better. And just, you know, just like anything, hey, it's a profession. You got to be professional. You have to know what you're doing and whatever you do. And so it's no different. You just got to, you know, that you have to evaluate the deals in this market a little harder than you did, you know, 5-6 years ago. But it's always doable. And you know, in a market where properties are going down, let's say, because this is a big, you know, people can't, it's like a stumbling block. When you're evaluating deals right now, you look at what they're selling for, and you know they're going to sell for the same price in about 3 months when you're done with it. You know, they should, roughly. And so, you know, it might even be a little bit more because we're seeing some pretty good appreciation. But let's just call it 2009 when values were going down. Well, if you're evaluating a property, seeing what you would pay for it, and the ARV today is 300, right? You know, well, if it's a three-month job, maybe it's only an eight-week job or less. You know, the odds are it's going to be worth a little less. So you got to run your numbers at like 285 or 290, knowing that, okay, hey, it's going to sell for some time less than 300. You have to plan for that. If it sells for 300, great. But the odds are, as the market's going down, so as long as you budget for that and you run your maximum allowable offer and you can pay for that off a lower amount than the comps you see today, you're going to be fine. You know, so it's just adapting your business to whatever's going on currently in the market. And so, you know, anybody who made it through the crash and, you know, and came out and is doing good was able to adapt. And that's the name of the game in any business, really. Is, you know, you got to be able to roll with the punches. And real estate investing is definitely one of those businesses. You got to be able to adapt to the change.
Yeah, you're right about that, Jim. So let's take a walk back to 2007. I think that first one, and maybe if we could just walk through play by play the discovery of, oh, wow, I can get a deal on the MLS. Because if I remember correctly, it was pretty damn tough in 2007 to buy investor-grade real estate inventory. It was as challenging as it is in today's market with the limited supply, maybe even worse to get something you can make a profit on. So can you walk us through play-by-play the deal that you originally saw listed for $440,000 and then ended up getting under contract for $300,000?
Yeah, so let me take a step back. So that was the second deal I ever did. That was the first deal I made money on. But the important part is when I told you how I was working with real estate investors, and I figured I could, you know, hey, I was finding them the properties, I was selling the properties for them. I didn't have anything to do with in the middle, you know, the contractor, the permits, the villages. But I'm like, how hard can all that process be? And boy, was I wrong. So I was in my first deal, and I had the wrong partner, the wrong contractor. I mean, I did everything wrong in the middle. I bought it right at the time, and had it been done as quickly for the budget amount that we set in the time frame, we would have been okay. Except the budget almost doubled. It took twice as long. The market started to change in the process. So I didn't know how much money I was going to lose on that property. I just knew there was going to be a loss, which I didn't have any money at the time. So I was desperate. Now I was still an agent, so I was showing houses to clients. And there was this one, this house on Sand Pebble, the one that was listed for $440, I showed to a client. Because it said it was actually updated, because that price is an updated price. Now, this was originally listed at 540. So it's down 100,000 from its original list price. It's on the market over 300 days. Now, I always check the background, being a good agent, doing research. There's no mortgage on this property. I already know that. So it's original owners. They bought it in 1984. The mortgage is paid off. So I know all this stuff, and we go there, show it to my client, and it's the ugliest updated house you've ever seen. Everything's blue, like blue countertops, little Corian with like white racing stripe, blue tile with like this
nice,
crazy bright white grout. It was a super nice lady. She ended up being a really nice lady from Greece, and blue was her color. And so there was blue everywhere. I mean, like blue carpet, blue wall, and it was new. It was fresh. It was updated. It was just nobody but her would like it, you know, or somebody who liked that much blue. So it was totally custom. She didn't do it to sell it. She did it for herself. But it was done within the last, you know, 4 or 5 years. So that's why it wasn't selling. You know, it was in a great market. It was in, like you said, it was in a market like, how do you get deals? And so I went and saw it with my client. Client not interested, but I'm desperate. In the back of my head, I'm like looking at this thing like, well, who knows what they could take for it? I already knew it had no mortgage on it because I looked that up. That was just part of my common practice as an agent prior to see if, you know, if I can get a good deal on something for somebody. And, you know, so I went back to the house on my own a couple of days later. And there's this owner-occupied. A lady lived in the house. So I ended up going back 4 times total, one with a client, 3 on my own. And every time the lady got more excited and more excited because, you know, she's like, oh, he's going to make an offer. And every time I called the agent, I would always say like, hey, man, because I knew I couldn't pay anywhere near 440. So I'd always be like kind of talking him down without completely doing it because I didn't want to lose him. So I would always call him and be like, hey, man, I love this thing, but oh, you priced it 440. I'm like, you know, I'm going to be closer to 300 than I am 400. You know, like, I don't want to waste your time. I don't want to insult you or your client, but I mean, it's not selling, obviously, because of the blue. Like, we both know it's updated, like you say in your listing, but come on, let's be real here. This thing is blue. And he's like, I know. Everybody says the same thing. He's like, look, just bring me your offer, and we'll see if we can put it together. So that's what I did. I put an offer together. At the time, the guy, you know, he was just a regular agent. He didn't know to ask for a proof of funds, and I didn't have one, so it was very convenient. and so I submitted the offer. At $300,000, of course, he's like, oh, my God, this is outrageous. You said it would be close to $300,000, not $300,000. You're wasting my time. Dropped a couple of F-bombs at me. I'm like, hey, man, look, could you just please go present the offer? Now, everybody listening, you might want to write this dialogue down because I still use this exact dialogue today. It's very powerful. And I say, look, you know, hey, John, you know, I'm not trying to insult you or your client, but based on what I do with the property, this is the most I can pay. I completely understand if you have to reject the offer, but that's the most I could pay based on what I would do with it. I think the as repaired value is somewhere close to $500,000. It needs, you know, $80,000 or $90,000 in renovation. This is the most I could possibly pay for it with the amount of work it needs. I understand it's updated. I know your client loves that. I get it, but that's too custom. We're going to have to redo everything. After, you know, got them swearing at me again, hung up, called me back. You know, he said, and this was so, I know how frustrating he was, but anyway, they did a $20,000 increment. So we were at 440, 420, every time I stayed, I hung up the phone with him. I called him back 5 minutes later every time and said, nope, 300 is it. So there's lots of these little phone calls, 380, 360, 340, 320. And then, you know, holy crap. Like, I'm like, are they about to accept my 300 offer? You know, of course they did. And so I was as surprised as anybody. I made that offer expecting it to get rejected. Okay. Like I didn't, there's no way in a million years I thought that was going to work. I've never done it before. It was $140,000 off. It was in a great neighborhood in a great market. The house was, you know, it was livable. It was just ugly, but it was totally clean and nice and it worked. And so, you know, if there's a will, there's a way. I had to go out and find the money. Now I had to also give the $5,000 earnest money, which I didn't have out of my own pocket. So, you know, if there's a will, there's a way. And I ended up finding an equity partner for that deal. An equity partner means somebody who is, you know, involved in the profit in the back end, right? So I found the deal. I did the work. Or, I mean, I helped manage the contract or whatever, and we split profit 50-50 in the back end. Now, that's not ideal. You want to just pay your private lenders, you know, an interest charge and where they have nothing to do with the profit. But I didn't have a choice here. So, you know, if you don't have a choice and you're new at this and, you know, like who cares about giving up profit in the back end when there's no profit if you can't do the deal, right? I mean, just get the deal done. And so I didn't, you know, I was desperate anyway. And that's why that deal came together. So we ended up selling. This is crazy. This is, you can't even make this stuff up. I sold that property quickly because it was still, you know, still a pretty decent market. Market was starting to turn, but, you know, the prices on this neighborhood were still very good. We sold it for like 480-ish, somewhere on a high 400. We made about 70-some thousand on it. And that was on Thursday. So it closed on Thursday. And I owned that property for about 6 months from closing to closing. My nightmare property was the first deal, which I owned for about a year and a half. Closed on Friday, the very next day, like not the next week, not the next month. I mean, like one day. I mean, what are the odds of that actually happening? That the one I made the money on Thursday, and then literally Friday, the next day, I lost all of it because I only had half that.
Oh, God.
Of that deal. I'm not kidding you. You cannot make that stuff up. And then I never looked back. I kept going and going and going. Never, but that's the story of my first two deals. And then, you know, I never looked back, and, you know, I've been doing deals ever since.
Man, Jim, it sounds like one of those old school Las Vegas gambling tales. You know, the guy's like way in the hole and some miraculous, you know, puts a nickel that he finds on the floor in the jackpot and like wins and is able to pay off the bookie who's chasing him with a knife through the casino.
You know, I always say, you know, like I'm very big into, you know, like, you know, positive mindset stuff, and mindset is a very big deal to me. And I keep these quotes on my wall. And one of the ones I'm looking at right now that I look at every day is from, you know, Jim Rohn. And it says, if you want it bad enough, you'll find a way. If you don't, you'll find an excuse. Right. So it just goes to anything. You know, if you're trying to do something, it's just not working out. Your why is probably not strong enough. Right. And so, you know, to me, it was just a matter of mindset. I was going to do this. I was going to be a real estate investor. It's how I wanted to make my living, and I was going to make it happen. And, you know, I guess, you know, just depending on where you are at your life and your career, you got to be willing to go all in to make that happen sometime. And so got to believe in yourself. I believe in myself and just, you know, made it happen. I will tell you, there's a lot of self-doubt that comes in a lot of these at the beginning of starting out something new. There's no question about it. But if you believe in yourself, you'll make it happen.
Yeah, and that's a great example of, like, acting on faith, and you know you had to keep moving. Because, you know, a lot of people, I've heard the stories, you know, secondhand and sometimes even firsthand of similar experiences, Jim, where someone was facing the loss of some catastrophic amount of money. And you go from making, you know, whatever, a lot of people are making $50,000, $60,000, $100,000, $90,000 a year before they get into real estate, or even less, get themselves into a deal, find a lender, it turns out to be a bad deal, all of a sudden they're in the hole $40,000, $50,000, $60,000, $70,000, and they feel there's no option but to disappear. But then you have an example like yours, which is one to hold up and follow and say, look, here it is, acting on faith, going out, taking the next action, paying attention. You know, the universe is handing you the way out. I mean, literally closing on a Thursday and then closing on a Friday to make that hole. But if you would have stopped and, you know, froze up and stopped taking action, you know, you wouldn't have made that offer at $300,000 and, you know, even answered the phone when the agent was calling back each of those sequential $20,000 drops. I think that's great for new people who are newer in the business, or even people who've been in the business for a long time and get themselves behind the eight ball. Like, you know, you have to take action in order to find a way out. If there's no action, there's not going to be any solution, for sure.
No, and you made a great point. It's one that I stress, and it goes back to, you know, when you're presenting an offer of any kind, you always, always, always call the agent before you submit the offer, no matter what. You're just trying to build rapport with them. Introduce yourself to him or her if they don't know who you are. You're trying to get them to like you. The offer has nothing to do with the phone call. I mean, it does. It's why you're calling them. But all you're doing is calling to get them to like you. If you call somebody and let them talk about their listing or themselves and keep asking them questions, and, you know, about the business, about, you know, whatever they'll talk about. But you're calling about the deal. But, you know, some people are more talkative than others. If you hang up the phone with somebody, this is like, you know, going back to business basics. If you hang up the phone with somebody after a 10-minute conversation, and you only ask that person questions about them, their business, their listing, they're going to hang up the phone with you, and they're like, man, I really like that guy, Jim. I don't know why I liked him, but I liked him. But it's because they got to talk about themselves, and you didn't talk anything about yourself. That's why they liked you. And so, like, you always have to call the agent first. And, you know, to follow up with that, like, I get this question a lot, too. How do you get your lowball offers accepted? Because my record is actually 32% off the list price, right? 32% off the list price. My first one I just told you about, that I, you know, that was 31%, but I got 32. There was another deal, and I've done, you know, everything right there. I've done, you know, 29, whatever. Not every property is right for this, but this one was listed for 400, and I bought it for 273. And that was the same thing. It was on the market for a long time. This one was vacant. But the point is, I've never submitted a lowball offer in my life. And when I say that, when I say it in a live audience, I see people's eyes light up like, what do you mean? And you just told me you got 32% off. That's a pretty low ball offer. I'm like, well, it's a lower offer than they were listed for. But I'm going into that phone call with that agent knowing that my offer is the highest I can pay for that property in its current condition. I'm not making a low ball offer. Just because their property is overpriced for its condition doesn't make my offer a low ball. Now, if you're offering something that's completely out of line, don't get me wrong, there can be low ball offers. I'm not saying that low ball offer doesn't exist. I've never presented a lowball offer in my life because my offers always made sense. So that property that was listed for 400 that I bought for 273, we sold that for somewhere in the high 400s, but it needed like 100 and, you know, it was years ago now, but it needed like 110 in work. And so we could only pay X amount for it because it needed, you know, so much work. And so when you call the agent first, and, you know, what goes into that is the dance is called. And that's kind of what I explained about that first deal, how I kept going back to the property and kept going back to the property. Now, somebody lived in that house. So that, you know, I had to go back, not that I knew that I didn't have to. But what I learned over time is, you know, if it's a vacant house, I don't actually have to go to it anymore. If it's a, if the property I need a significant reduction on, I can just make the phone call, schedule a showing, ask for the showing that I, you know, a showing that I didn't go to. I went to the first one, and that's the only time I need to go. I know what I could pay already. But the seller and the agent need to get the right mindset on their side of what they're going to take. Because if I'm, they're at 400, I'm at 273, I got to set the stage right for that. So I call and schedule a showing. I don't go. After the showing that they think I went to, I call the agent, like, I love this house. You know, like I called, like, man, I just, you guys are at 400. I'm going to be closer to 3 than I am 4. I'm like, I'm going to make an offer as high as I possibly can. I'm going back to my office right now. I'm going to run my numbers again. I want this house. I love this neighborhood. You want to get the agent excited about it so they can go back to the seller. Because a house that's been on the market for 300 plus days, that agent doesn't have much good to say to the sellers. And the sellers probably aren't very happy with the agent. So if you're giving them some positive, like, feedback, like good energy through the phone, they're going to take it like, this guy loves this house. I think he's going to make a cash offer. You know, everybody's going to get excited on their side of it. So my wife used to call that my acting debut, by the way, because, you know, she would be in the car with me before we had kids and would hear me make these phone calls quite often. So it wasn't I was lying. I was kind of just pouring it on. You know, I was like, oh, I love this thing. And I would hang up. She'd be like, what was that? But it worked, and it got me the deals, you know. And so that is there's just so many strategies that you know, come up that basically is – It's negotiating without them knowing it, right? That's what it is. It's like planting these mental triggers. And I don't have a way to talk to the seller when using deals in the MLS, which I actually like. So you have to give all your information to the agent to take it to the seller. And so there's ways to manipulate the deal for it to go your way. It doesn't always, you know, I mean, we get about 10 to 12% of the offers we put out. Now, these are detailed, structured offers in the MLS, right? So I'm not talking about, you know, like OfferBot style offers. I'm talking about, like, you have somebody go see it, you run your numbers on it, and then you put in an offer, like a legitimate offer, and you get about 10 to 12%, you know, of what you do. So mindset is very important. And calling the agent before, most people don't call the agent before they submit the offer because they are submitting a lowball offer, or they don't know if their offer is good enough or not, and they're just embarrassed. And so if I go see a house that's for 400 one time, I don't call the agent at all. I don't give any feedback, which is what usually happens. And then I email them in an offer that says, here's the most I could pay. The house needs a lot of work. Thanks. And it's for 273. What do you think is going to happen? They're going to email me back or maybe call me and say, hey, are you serious? This offer is rejected because the stage wasn't set properly for that particular kind of offer. That's just one of the many strategies that I teach, but still, that's a great one. And that's one I call fishing for deals in the MLS. Like whenever I, you know, if there's nothing new that's on right now, which is rare that I can't just open the MLS and find a deal, I go fishing. So I have my VA look for deals that are over 300 days of market time, and then no mortgages, and then send me all those properties so I can review them. And so that's just how I start with fishing in the MLS. There's always, always opportunity there in any kind of market.
Yeah, so you brought up a couple of the details, and I'm thinking to myself, Jim, I wholesale, obviously, I'm 5-6 different markets around the country, and I see deals everywhere from Southside Chicago that we're putting together for 10, 20, 30 grand all the way up to, you know, $600,000-$800,000 houses that we're buying for same kind of discounts and numbers that you're talking about here. And I've experienced there's a certain liquidity and a certain amount of competition in many of the quote unquote like investors / cash flow / Section 8 neighborhoods that work for that, where the MLS kind of gives us some vibrant activity and like a lot of competition, and the deals kind of move quick. Is there a sweet spot in the MLS price point wise, ARV wise? You did mention 100 days on market with no mortgage. What other criteria would you use if you were combing through or trying to identify a market where potentially this would work, fishing for deals on the MLS, if there is a better place to win as opposed to, you know, just blanket doing the entire market? All price points.
No, there absolutely is, especially in a market as diverse as like suburban Chicago. You know, we have so much up and down here within, you know, 45 minutes of my office. We have, you know, houses that can sell for $5 million, and we have houses that can sell for $5,000, literally. So, you know, you really have to pick your market strategically. And what, you know, what's important to look at is, you know, the amount of closed properties in a neighborhood. Like if you have a neighborhood you think you want to work in, you start evaluating it, you know, you can go on the MLS or you go, you know, there's plenty of online free tools to look at what properties are selling for. Truly, they all have it now, as far as what the properties in the neighborhood have closed for. So that's an important statistic to look at is that, you know, how many are closing in the last, you know, the last 3 months is very important. If I'm evaluating a property that I'm considering buying, and I look back 3 months and there's no comps within a 1 mile radius that are similar to that property, I just don't buy it, plain and simple. I'm not going to try to make it a deal. I'm not going to try to like, well, what if, or the, you know, unless you know that market really, really good and know that houses don't sell because people hold on to them for a long time, or there's something unique about that market. But, you know, just in a nutshell, if you're new and you don't see a comp that you can use that's within the last 3 months, the odds are you probably shouldn't buy that property. But let's say that there is comps in the last 3 months for your property. Let's say there's lots of them. I'm like, okay, there's lots of sales. But what's also important to look at, and people always fail to do this, is you need to look at the active property. Those are not comps, but those are the losers that haven't sold yet. And I'll give you an example. I got a call the other day from a guy who is, he doesn't know this market well, which is why he got referred to me. And he's a member of a pretty big national organization that, you know, a lot of people would know, but either way, he was looking to do new construction in not too far from here in Pinellas. And, you know, they were looking at like, there's not a lot of sales. There's a couple. So we think we have a market here. And I'm like, well, did you look at which I was a little surprised by, did you look at the active stuff? Because there was in that market where it would be selling, there was 12 active with 462 days of market time on average, which means there was some that had more than that and some that had less than that. And so, but the average was over 400. I'm like, so, you know, if you do buy this property due to new construction, just know that you have to price it well below all these other new constructions that have nobody's ever lived in also. So these are all brand new. So that actually obviously talked them out of doing the deal because it didn't make sense. Because not because the sold looked okay. There were some sales, but the actives is what killed that deal. So it's important to look at the actives too. And, you know, I always had, as an agent, I always had sellers that would bring up, oh, well, my neighbor's listed for this, my neighbor's listed for that. And I would always I have two things. One, my dialogue with, well, the active ones are the losers that haven't sold. So let's keep that in mind. Nobody's paid those prices. And two, let me just show you the expired list of properties in the last 6 months for your neighborhood. These are all the properties that are no longer on the market that did not sell. And you can expand that to the whole town or, you know, whatever. But either way, you can always make it look like, so not every property gets to sell. And the ones that are active that aren't selling, like, let's talk about your neighbors on the market for 242 days. Well, they're one of the losers that haven't sold yet, and it's because their price is too high. Every single property has a price and condition barometer, right? So meaning if you have a $2 million house in any market, that's going to be a pretty nice house, right? Well, if it's a $2 million house, it's priced at $4 million. It's still not going to sell because it's $2 million overpriced. But if they listed it at $1,999,000, that's going to be gone in a heartbeat because that's the right price. Right. So every house, it doesn't matter how nice or how crappy, has a price, somebody will pay for it. But you have to hit the price and condition have to match up for the market. So just make sure you're evaluating everything on the market, not just the properties that have closed, because I've had people that got in a lot of trouble not looking at the actives, thinking that there's nothing relevant about them. But that gives you a tremendous amount of data looking at the actives. That should be the end clincher to, yep, this is a deal I should do or I shouldn't.
So, I mean, we're investing a lot of time here, and from the examples, it sounds like the sweet spot's kind of more like stuff that's worth $350,000, $150,000 because you're investing a certain amount of time and, you know, you're going to get the opportunity on a deal of that price point if the deal goes the way you expect it to make, I don't know, anywhere from $50,000 to $70,000 on average, whereas maybe the time investment won't be worth it in a neighborhood where the retail sales are $100,000 to $125,000, $150,000, and they're kind of more like that, you know, landlord investor type of neighborhood. Is there a price point that you stick to or that you find that this is most effective for you to invest your time, like houses that are, you know, listed in the 400 range that are all grandma'd up, you know?
Yeah, I love that stuff. I love estate sales. Estate sales are my favorite sale to buy, whether they're probates that aren't listed in the MLS or they're MLS deals. I just love them. They're usually just, you know, just cosmetically dated, but pretty well cared for houses overall, usually. But I usually buy, you know, in the 200 to 300 range where I'm buying them, because that's just, you know, that's the market that I, in my area, because we're selling those, okay, we're selling those between, you know, 400 and 500 is usually where I sell most of my house. So I have a couple that are bigger than that right now, but most of the stuff I have will sell between 400,000 and 500,000. There's a couple of reasons that I stay in that zone. One, you know, if they're putting down a minimum down payment, that is still within, you know, if they want to go, don't want to go to a jumbo loan, the conventional guidelines, they just raised them up. And I got an email about it not that long ago. I believe they actually went to 419. It didn't go up that much, but conventional guidelines did go up. So if your loan amount prior, it was 417. So we'll just call it 417. It did go up a couple thousand, but I forget the exact number. So if your loan amount was 417 or under, then you would be, it would be conventional financing. If your loan amount was 417 or over, it's jumbo. Now, for a while there, jumbo had really good rates, and that, you know, things have changed with that. But a lot of people are trying to stay in that conventional loan. They don't want to go to jumbo. So if I sell for 500, you know, they have to put down at least, you know, 70 grand, 75,000 to stay within that, those conventional, you know, conforming guidelines. So they don't have a jumbo loan. So, you know, you think about like, well, why don't you sell all the way up? Well, because, you know, in a lot of my market, 600, you know, to 600 to 900,000 is very slow. There's a lot of developers that came into a lot of these markets, started tearing houses down and selling them in that range, 699, you know, to 899. And they are there's some specific markets around. I had a house in one of them that everything was sitting. It was in Glen Ellen, which is just south of here. And so you really got to watch like the amount of inventory, the amount of sales, the amount of tear downs that are going on. That's just, you know, so my sweet spot is, you know, selling between 400 and 500. It's because they are the easiest deals. The financing is the easiest. You don't have to worry as much about, you know, in that price point. There's no new construction that is going to come in and could bump you out or could, you know, hinder your sale. But the financing today is the hardest it's ever been. The last 2 years of financing is absolutely brutal. You know, when everything took a turn in 2008 and all the lending guidelines tightened up, I would take that financing from 2008 that everybody said, oh my God, you can't get a loan. I would take that all day long over what we have today, because there's so much BS regulation in the underwriting. It's out of control. And so it makes it very difficult to get loans done. But the people that are able to buy at the 400 to 500 price point with a 10% down payment, you know, some of them have 20, but most of them have 10, but you can even do 5% conventional if you have good enough credit. And those are the easiest loans to do. And I'll give you an example that happened to me last year on one of my deals. The sale price was 220. Like that was the after repaired value, or 240 even. But anyway, they were 2 weeks late on the closing date. Closing date was set, and they did not hit it. They didn't give us a clear to close either. They said, you know, we're still working on a few things. So on a Tuesday, we got the clear to close. So they scheduled it for Thursday. So 2 days later, we're at the closing. I wasn't there. I don't go to the closings, but my attorney was. And so they signed the paperwork. And anybody who's been to a closing knows, once all the paperwork is signed, it's like the buyer's usually kind of giddy and happy, because it's like the moonlighting period before, you know, the lender reviews the document, calls back and says, hey, yep, we're good. Cut the check. They own a house. And they get all happy and they get the keys. Well, you know, in this case, the moving truck was literally in the driveway. And they signed all the paperwork. Everybody's all happy. And they get the call from the lender saying, oh, hey, sorry, we're no longer going to lend on this house. Have a nice day. They literally pulled the financing at the closing table. I didn't even know that was possible.
Wow.
After you got the clear to close, yeah, it was Fifth Third Bank. It was brutal. So I've since learned that the clear to close basically means nothing. If you read the fine print, it's they can do whatever they want. So there's nothing you could do. There's no recourse for anybody when they did that. And it was a mistake that we ended up closing it 3 weeks later. But it was just an underwriting mistake. The underwriter thought she overlooked something but didn't, and pulled the financing. And anyway. So it was a mess, but that's the kind of stuff we're seeing today. There's so much regulation, and the underwriters are so worried about getting in trouble, losing their job, they're doing something wrong, that they're doing crazy things in the underwriting. They're asking for, it's over and over. It's out of control. So the sweet spot for me in my market is the 400 to 500. That buyer is the easiest financing. And again, there's a couple of reasons, because there's no new construction at that price. There's just a lot of upside to that. The lower you get in my market and price point, the harder the financing gets, because, you know, you get all these FHA regulations. Now all our houses meet the FHA guidelines, but the FHA underwriter, now that's a different story, because that has nothing to do with us. And so we're having deals that are taking, you know, 60, 70 days to potentially get closed, and then they're falling apart in the 11th hour, and there's nothing we could do about it, because they get their earnest money back, because it's contingent upon the mortgage. So at the end, they can't get it. Sorry, this didn't work out. And the deal's dead. You're back on the market 70 days later, and you got all this extra holding costs. And now you're just back looking for another buyer, hoping they're not FHA this time. You know, so that's why I stay where I stay personally.
Got it. I think there's an additional risk being, you did mention some of that, $600,000 to $900,000, and that being built in the jumbo loans. But as the interest rates are hiking right now, January 2017, for those listening in posterity, do you feel, Jim, that it's more risky to be above the 500,000? Like, I know that when the market changed 2007, 2008, and 2009, that price point fell off drastically and dramatically further and farther, if I can remember correctly, in Philadelphia market where I was, than say the $200,000 to $400,000 price point. Do you happen to share the same belief, or could you shed some light on, you know, a potential market shift and its effect on that 500 above price?
Well, yeah, it's market dependent, right? I mean, if you're looking at the inventory, you got to see the market you're in and just see what's going on with the inventory. You know, there's where we are in the higher price points, there's a good amount of inventory in most cases. And so, you know, jumping into that market, if you're buying one, you know, rehab that you're going to do, and you're going to end up being just part of that active inventory, then you just, you know, be cautious that you're going to be priced at a point where you're going to be able to sell. So I choose not to be in that, you know, when that's going on. Like, you know, I'll give you an example. Like right now, I had two properties that I finished right about the beginning of December. And so I put them on the market for a couple of weeks. It was actually, I finished it just before Thanksgiving, now that I think about it. And I put them on the market for a couple of weeks. We had like one showing, one offer on the one. Put under contract, buyer backed out, got cold feet. So I put it back on and there was nothing for 2 weeks, not one showing. And it's a great house, great price. So I took it off the market. I'm like, you know what? This is the market was, the showings were unusually low. You know, after an election, it doesn't matter who wins the election. After an election, the market slows down for a little while. It's just the way it is. So knowing that, I'm like, you know what? If I leave these on the market, I probably won't get an offer until maybe January or February. So they're going to have all this market time and they're going to look like nobody wanted them. I pulled it off the market. I had another one. Same thing. I put on the market for 2 weeks, one showing, interested, but wasn't ready to pull the trigger and kept waiting. I pulled it off the market because I knew if they were just waiting and waiting, they were going to make me a lower offer and the house is priced well. It just was very, like, I'll give you an example. The showings at that time, I follow my office showings. So these are not my listings, but my entire office. We were under 100 showings for my entire office for the week at this time. This past Monday, which we're, you know, mid-January now, we had 352 showings. So the showings have literally quadrupled since this time when I took them off the market in December. So if that picks up by 10%, meaning if we have 380 showings or more by next week, for me, I'm going to list those properties again because that is a great activity amount for me to put them back on and expect, you know, the buyers to be present that will buy and pay the amount that I'm looking for. But just like anything, supply and demand, right? If there's enough supply, then, you know, enough demand, then your property's worth more. If there's, you know, too much supply and not enough demand, your house is worth less, plain and simple. So I saw the writing on the wall. I know that incurring the extra holding costs during these times when I have it off the market will wash itself out with what I'll be able to sell it for. You know, mid-February was the plan to relist it, because in our market, that's when it gets really, the spring market starts about mid-February these last 3 or 4 years.
Yeah, and we've done, so I mean, that's a great strategy, Jim. We've done that, you know, even in non-election years, because people just mid-December, they're Christmas shopping and they're making travel arrangements and they're just getting over Thanksgiving. And it's like the activity where, you know, we've done that year after year after year at that period of time with a couple slow properties that we probably would have been better off some of not doing those deals and getting that same impact you're describing. So I can like testify to that same positive impact, even though for 30 to 45 days or so while my property's sitting off the market, I got that interest clock running in the back of my mind, but it ended up, in most cases, paying off to reset the clock and not have us looking like that stale listing that move coming through the, you know, with price after price drop. We even increased the price and came back on, you know, $10,000, $12,000, $15,000 higher on the properties that I'm thinking about and been rewarded and made additional money than if we got a full price offer previous to when we pulled the listing.
Yep. No, exactly. That's exactly. So we'll evaluate. I'll evaluate next week, see where the prices are. I mean, I think mine will stay the same, but I don't know. I got to look at it. We'll see.
Cool. So, Jim, I think I know the answer to this, and I'm going to ask the question slightly different. Is there a single idea, system, strategy that you've implemented or improved over the last 12 to 24 months, which, you know, caused exponential growth as a result?
Yeah, you know, and what's funny is it's a productivity thing within my own office, my own desk. It's how I handle, like, this is, you know, it's you know, time management, essentially, oddly enough. And there's no, you don't have to buy anything for this. It is literally like email management. Email, you know, manages all of our lives. And so it's crazy, but, you know, Google says the average Gmail account gets, the average adult gets 150 emails a day. The average adult gets 150 emails a day. And so I'm no different. I have a couple of folders, but still, it's just overwhelming. So I started, you know, implementing where I only allow my inbox to send me emails. There's a thing called inbox pause, where you can only send your emails during specific times. So now I only get my emails at noon and 4, and that's the only times that I'm responding to them. And so I don't have my email on my phone anymore. I took, like, it used to be right in the bottom of my iPhone, so like everybody, I could see as soon as I could. So I actually originally hid it in a folder, so I had to go find it. And now I don't check my email from my phone anymore at all. And it's like, and same thing with social media. Social media is something that's a huge time waster. You don't need to do it. It's just really more self-serving than anything. And I'm honest, don't get me wrong, but a lot of stuff is more for business, and I post some, you know, personal stuff just so it's not all business. But I don't do social media on my phone either. That's gone. So it's just, you know, removing the time wasters, focusing your time. If you get rid of email on your phone and you only check email at specific times and you only respond to email at specific times, it will change your life. I mean, when you sit at your computer, like, I have no pings, I have no dings. I have, like, you know, anybody who texts me, or, you know, when I did have email on my phone, I did not have any pings or dings associated with that. So it could never go ding. And I would like, oh my God, let me look. I never had that. I always had that off. But then I was still checking to see, do I have a new one? I would have a new message. So since I, like, took that and streamlined it, made it a system, made it a process, it has, like, changed my it's a very, very, and so everything gets better. I get more time at home. I get more time, you know, I get more accomplished in less time. It's just, the email trap is, it's impossible to get out of. And if you don't grab a hold of it, it will grab a hold of you, which it does to everybody, including me. So it was a process to get it under control. It's not perfect, but I highly recommend getting that process under control for yourself, because it will give you more time than you could ever imagine.
Who would you identify, Jim, as being, you know, a highly successful real estate investor or developer? And could you also define why they're successful?
No, that's a big question, right? Like, well, you know, I guess it depends on how you define success, right? Is success just monetary? Is success, you know, is it somebody who makes money but has a lot of time? Is it, you know, because to me, success is freedom, right? It's freedom and it's time. And for me, time is just with my family, and I need to make money, but money is not the driving factor for me anymore. I mean, I need it. I want it. I make it, but it's no longer the driving factor. So, you know, if I look at, you know, a lot of people that are, you know, successful, and I put up air quotes because you see them on Facebook and they got a great Facebook page and they're a Facebook rock star. But, you know, then it's funny, if you're being in different, you know, mastermind groups and different channels, you hear like, well, things aren't that great there. This isn't that, you know, like, it's just very interesting what you hear about what you think. And so it's just I guess you really have to know somebody pretty well to know how, you know, well-rounded their success actually is. Because to me, it has nothing to do with money and success. That's actually the last key for me in success. When I started out in business, it was the only thing. And for me now, it's at the back. I mean, money's there. Don't get me wrong. It's absolutely a factor, but it's not the most important by far. You know, health, family, time, you know, just lots of stuff to me are so. I know it's a long-winded answer to the question, but just a simple answer to pick somebody to put on somebody. When I started in the business, and the first education I got, I had no money. I put $10,000 in my credit card, which their course is now $25,000. And but I met Sam Merrill back then, and we're the same age. Very, you know, very impressive dude. But he has come. What they have done in the time that they've you know been doing this, since they started in 2003, has been very, very impressive. How far they've come. What, you know, they you know the coaching element now. So Dan Merrill's guy with you know CT Homes, which are on A&E's Flip This House, and then they're also on, or they're Fortune Builders, which is their coaching element, and that's hitting, you know, crazy numbers too. Because I mean, it's a great program. You know, Dan seems to have things pretty dialed into how he's run his business. You know, I mean, he wrote a book. You know, with that guy from the E-Myth real estate. Well, the E-Myth is from Michael Gerber, but the E-Myth real estate investor is from, you know, is Michael Gerber wrote it with Sam Merrill and Paula Sagan. So in my experience, people that I know, because I know Sam pretty well, he's, you know, the friend, he has a pretty well-rounded life and business. And so, you know, a lot of people that I know that are successful, I don't know enough about them to say, hey, that's somebody I would want to be like. But Sam, you guys couldn't tell I talk fast. I'm wired in a way that I do things pretty quickly. You know, Sam and I have a similar mindset that way. So if I have to put a name to it, I would say Sam, and that's why.
Nice. Well said. Great reason. Great definition of success. Jim, two or three book recommendations that you've made most often.
Yeah, you know, I'm actually reading right now, which I've been meaning to read for years, I cannot find enough time to read it fast enough. I'm actually taking speed reading courses right now so I can read this book and others faster. But The 4-Hour Workweek by Tim Ferriss, fantastic. I mean, just every single chapter, I'm learning something awesome about time and management, and just it's fantastic. So he has all these email things in there too, which are freaking awesome. So I was already doing them, but, like, you know, he gave me some other good tips in there. And he also came out with a book. This is just a side note. He just came out with a book called Tools of Titans. So this dude basically, the 4-Hour Workweek is about productivity and how to work less. And Tool of Titans is all these tools, and it's a 600-page book, Tool of Titans. I haven't even gotten into it yet. It's my next book. I cannot wait. because Tim is just an expert at, you know, at digging out and getting the details of how to use things and do things and be productive. It's awesome stuff. Another great book, Seven Habits of Highly Effective People by Stephen Covey. Great, great book. But the one that's changed my life the most is Tony Robbins. I don't know who Tony Robbins is, but Tony Robbins is he's a speaker. You know, he doesn't like to be called a motivational speaker because that's not what he does if you know him well. But he has a book called Awaken the Giant Within. Awaken the Giant Within. And you can actually get that book. Well, he has a seminar that's like his entry-level seminar. It's 4 days. That's basically what that book is. So the book is the book, but the seminar is the live version of the book. But you can get his book for free. If you Google Reawaken, like R-E-Awaken, the Giant Within, it'll take you to his page where you can get that entire book, the Reawaken, like the rewritten version, a free download of the entire book. So I highly, highly recommend that.
Nice, Jim. And if you could share the crown jewel of wisdom with your 18-year-old self, what would that be?
So much. So much. But if I mean, I would have talked to him for months and months and really slap him into shape. Because, you know, I didn't really, like, come into my own way until my early 30s. I'm in my, you know, late 30s now. And so it was just funny. It's been a process all the way through. But, you know, I've never been diagnosed with ADD. I don't really believe in, like, going to get, because it is what it is. Just got to deal with it. And I don't want to take medication for anything anyway. So, but I have a highly active brain, right? Like, I'm like most entrepreneurs, I have entrepreneurial ADD, like, on steroids. And so, you know, for me, something I didn't learn till more, you know, the last, you know, 6-7 years of my life is to focus, right? Like, literally, like, focus on what you're working on. If it doesn't help your current plan, what you're trying to grow and do, get rid of it. Get it off your desk. Get out. You don't get the emails. If it's an email that you're getting because it's something you wanted to do, so you're on somebody's list, but it doesn't have to do with what you're currently doing, get it out of your inbox. Either if you still want it, put it in a folder where you don't see it at all until you're ready to go back and see it. But just focus and get, you know, keep on track with what you're doing. Like I'm a master at, you know, at putting too much on my plate and trying to do it all at once. And so I've realized, you know, like I said, the last 5, 6, 7 years that, you know, getting focused and just, you know, like when I'm at the office, I turn off my cell phone off. It's like not even on, so I can't look at it. And my wife has my office number. She's the only one that has this office number. It's the only one that'll ring. So if there's an emergency with her and my kids, she can get me. But like turning off my phone and having real focused time where I'm working up. Because if you have your dings and bings on your phone and you know, like I heard this, is from Dan Kennedy. And I heard this like, man, 5 years ago. And I'm like, I am not doing that. He was saying like at Disneyland in their zoo exhibit or their safari exhibit, they have all these animals in the same big, huge pen, this huge area. And so the zebras, they come for this one ding, bing. And then the lions are like, and then the lions come. And there's all these different dings for each animal to feed. And he's like, when you're, because anybody can ding you, right? He said, so anybody who has your number can ring your phone or can ding, you know, can ding your text message. And he's like, so it's like you're one of those animals. If anybody has trained you to then look at your phone and pick it up and like, oh, let me respond to this person because what they have must be so important because my phone just dinged. Because you get trained that way. And I heard that and I was like, man. Turn all that stuff off. So I had that stuff turned off for years before I even got my email stuff in check. But anyway, that's a long answer to focus. You know, like to like have time block focus time every day. You should try to learn something new every day. That's what I would tell myself. It's like time block, focus. You know, you have to do that if you're going to be productive, if you're going to try to grow a business of any kind.
If anybody listening wants to find out more about Jim Hunziker, do you have some information you'd like to share with the audience?
Sure, they can get me at my main page. I'm the founder of the Real Estate Investor Academy and I'm creator of MLS Domination. They can get me at www.realestateinvestoracademy.com. That's my main page these days. And anything I'm doing or wherever I'm at or more information on MLS Domination, what we're doing with it right now will be on that page. And, yeah, that's where to find me, man.
Cool. Hey, Jim, I really appreciate it. I know it was hard for you to block out this app here to spend with us here on the My Diamond Show. I really want you to know that I appreciate it, and I know that the listeners appreciate it as well. So thank you for coming on the show.
Hey, no problem. I was happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamond Show. Are you interested in receiving email notifications of future episodes of the show? You can sign up at www.reidiamonds.com or subscribe through one of the podcast apps, including iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. Are you interested in either buying a deal from me or presenting one of your deals or listings for me to buy from you? Either way, you could submit deals you'd like to sell or check out deals I have for sale in Chicago, Atlanta, Florida, or Philadelphia by going to www.reidiamonds.com and clicking the link at the top of the page. Finally, if you have certain questions or topics you'd like discussed on a future episode, or if you have a guest suggestion, someone you'd like me to invite on the show, perhaps even yourself to be on the show, you can contact me by clicking on the contact Dan link at www.reidiamonds.com. If you visit that site and sign up, I have some cool bonuses, including a book on wholesaling that I wrote available for free download. And you can also find out about real estate investor networking groups. That's our ring meeting, which we hold in a few of the markets that we are currently operating. So make sure you check that out, reidiamonds.com. And once again, thank you for being a loyal listener of my show. I appreciate you. Dan Breslin here, and I'll catch you on the next episode.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin. To receive email notifications of new weekly episodes, sign up at www.reidiamonds.com.